For some reason, I'm imagining this, like, dirt pit in a back alley and 36 people coming with their, you know, bloodthirsty hounds and unleashing them all in a pit, and, like, everyone wants their own dog to win, but they're all just mauling each other and everyone's screaming and having a great time.
Okay, Mike Vick.
Greetings, listeners. Welcome to another episode of The Sophisticates. I'm Matt Patches, and I'm once again joined by my fellow intelligentsia, Rajan Mudambi.
Being very intelligent, I
yes,
hope.
I would expect nothing less. And, of course, Ryan Pfister, fresh from his adventure across the nation.
Yes, filled with fresh intelligentsia.
I hope you got even more intelligent by watching the serene vistas of Americana pass you by. But we'll get into that as our first topic directly relates to that. But I'm spoiling things. I'm getting ahead of myself. I should dramatically introduce that we, of course, have three amazing topics this week, and we should get right into it. So here is our first topic, the merits of cross-country train travel. So I am very interested to hear from Ryan Pfister, who didn't actually choose this topic, but I am forcing him to discuss a trip that he took this past week. Is that right, Ryan?
That's correct. Monday night.
My knowledge of this is that you boarded a train, yes, Monday night, and you traveled across the country.
Yes, almost all the way. I traveled down to New Orleans from D.C., and then and the next day we boarded a train again and went west all the way to Tucson, Arizona, and then I flew home.
Holy cow. I find that amazing. First off, how did you decide to do this? How did you decide to do that?
My friend from college was going all the way to Tucson for a wedding, and he decided that he had some extra time off the burn, so he would take a train instead of flying.
I believe your friend was actually a guest host.
Yes, a previous guest on the Sophisticates, Andrew McGill. And so he was going, and I joined along.
But, like, I remember you discussing once on the Sophisticates that there was something about the West or about being out of your element and kind of soaking in nature and the scenic nothingness of certain parts of America. Did that play into you deciding to do the trip at all?
A little bit. I mean, I think that the train, you get to see more of the United States versus just the West, you know. So I actually got to see, you know, parts of the South. You know, one guy on the train called it the backyard of America. And it was really true. I mean, you're literally just going through a whole bunch of people's backyards. So it's not like on the interstate where there's just McDonald's and nothing on either side. You know, you're passing people's houses and pulling into a whole bunch of towns. I mean, out west, you know, we definitely went through the Texas desert, and there's a whole round of nothing out there. Especially, you know, you just get on the middle. There's no data reception. There's just some shrubs everywhere. But you see a little bit of that, the freedom element that I was talking about earlier. But I think that you lose some of that if you're not in a car.
Really? So you're not road tripping in some cases?
Well,
weird
because
way.
You have the other people on the train, you know, like you still feel that community with the rest of the train, as opposed to like, well, because we rented a car in Tucson and we actually still drove out in the middle of nowhere, like into this giant cactus field. And it's a different feeling when you're, you know, you're just by yourself in this car and you get out of the car and you're in the middle of nowhere.
But I feel like that's what's so entertaining to me about this concept of taking a big train trip across the country. You know, we talk so much about road tripping, like that's a really dreamy, you know, Jack Kerouac type activity. It seems so mystical. But taking a train, like you meet a lot of, I assume that you would meet a lot of people, and it's like a different kind of experience. Granted, my grandma is like the only person I knew who took a train trip across the America, but you're probably a lot like my grandma. But, you know, I assume that you met a lot of people.
We did, you know, and that's kind of part of the thing that is a big differentiator between the train and the car. Is with the car, it's sort of like an expression of freedom through control, and that you choose where you want to go and you drive there. Whereas the train, it is just like an ultimate lack of control. Like you really kind of, because the train is just so slow, like you'll get stuck behind freight trains or the track will be bad and you have to go really slow. And it just takes so long. I mean, it usually takes longer than driving. So you basically just have to, like, give up on getting anywhere fast, you know, or just even being in a hurry. You just kind of just totally chill out. And, you know that the train's going to get there when it's going to get there. So there's just no hurry. It's just train time. You know, we constantly have these things. We just hang out meals and talk to people because, you know, there was you didn't have anything to get to.
Who did you meet?
You know, we met a lot of older people, you know, kind of semi-retired or retired, just taking the train trip for fun. A bunch of people, like, they lived in Houston. They went back to New Orleans to hang out for the night and then came back the next day. A few commuters coming from DC, like just not like daily commuters, but they were coming home from some kind of trip to DC, like a business trip. And just, you know, let's see, we met like a divorcee who was hanging out, burning some time, going to visit somebody out west.
So it's not,
You know.
but not many people doing what you were doing, I assume. It sounds like.
What do you mean by doing what we were doing? Like
Taking
we.
a cross-country trip in a train.
Oh, well, yeah, I don't think we found too many people that were doing a double trip and like in the sense that they were taking one train trip and then getting on another train and going even farther,
Right.
which is what we did. Most people were just taking one leg, like they would start in New Orleans and go all the way.
I don't think many people would consider doing this. Do you feel that way? And you, Rajan? I mean, like, the thought of doing this really hadn't crossed my mind until you brought it up, and I think it sounds like the most awesome trip. But I don't think many people consider it.
I think for me, I've definitely considered it, largely because my uncle is a huge train enthusiast, so if I did, I would go with him.
What does that mean? That he's a huge train enthusiast.
I don't know. He's a big fan of taking trains. Whenever he travels around the country a lot, and whenever he goes into like a city, he has to try out the like all the public transit, whether it's a light rail or a subway or a regional rail or whatever, just like take it wherever, not regardless of, I mean, independent of where he needs to be, he would, you know, take
Right. He's
the.
observing it for his
Yeah,
own
I mean,
mental
so like
encyclopedia.
he came to visit me in New York a couple of years ago, and he insisted that we take the PATH train off to New Jersey and then take the Hoboken light rail,
Awesome.
just for fun. So, I mean, I could see myself doing that with him. On the other hand, I feel like, I mean, it does take a long time,
Yeah.
and there may be other things I would rather do in my time off. You know, if I have a week off, I might prefer to do something other than take a train the whole time. I don't
So,
know.
do you
I'd have to
think the
think about it.
destination is more important for you than like the getting there?
No, it's not necessarily.
Do you think it's that way for a lot of people?
I think it is for a lot of people. I think for me, I'm not a like I like trains. Like, so if I were going to go from New York to Philly, I would prefer to take a train every time. That absolutely. Like, I like trains for, you know, 4 to 5 hour trips or whatever, or in that case, like a 2 hour trip. But I think
Why do you like them better? Is it just, yeah.
I like them because you, well, I think I like them for the same reasons I like flying, which is that you just get on and you don't have to think about anything and then you get off and you can read or you can sleep or you can do whatever. And like with buses, you get a little bit of that, but they're generally more cramped and the lights generally don't work and it's
I love
kind
that
of.
you're comparing trains and airplanes right now. There are, it's all just one big group of things that you can sleep on.
No, well, I mean, yeah, you can sleep on those. But I'm thinking in the terms of it's a long, you generally, they're long distance, long time trips where you just kind of disconnect from the world. And so that in that sense, I'm comparing
You're
them.
so emo.
No, but that's it's true. Like that is what the train trip that I kind of miss that now, is that it's just a total like disengagement when you're on the train. You know, you have nowhere to be, and and nothing in particular to do. You know, I definitely reckon we didn't bring our laptops, and that was a great decision.
You did not bring your laptops.
We did not bring the laptop, you know, and so you just relax and kind of, you know, rediscover this art of you know, chilling out. I guess you kind of get a taste of what some people do in retirement.
Right. It's funny because I think in the beginning of a trip like that, I would get a little, like, skittish about not being so disconnected and trying to kind of mellow out. But do you feel that way in the beginning of your trip, and then later you kind of get in the groove of what riding long distance trains is all about?
Yeah. I mean, you definitely get some of that. I remember, like, Andrew and I hadn't seen each other in a while, so we were trying to catch up on a lot of different topics, and then we were like, oh wait, like, we have 35 hours to burn. So we just kind of wrote down the things that we were going to talk about to each other over the course of the trip.
Oh, that's deep.
And yeah, we just, like, you know, talked about them like 20 hours later, you know, because there was no hurry.
So what was the coolest thing you saw on your train trip? Because I'm just curious about specifics, that the things that you couldn't have gained on a different and on experiencing this trip in a different way, I guess.
Well, you know, a few people have asked me that, and I think that it's definitely a journey thing. Like, I definitely saw some cool stuff. You know, that seeing just the desert and
I know I saw a picture,
like,
of a
backyards.
Missile silo. You saw a missile.
That was like a pretty cool single thing. There was a missile silo we saw, like an old decommissioned missile silo, and a boneyard for old Air Force planes.
Where was
out
that?
In Tucson too. That was out in Tucson because the humidity is low, so the planes don't rust as much. But it's really about, like, the real experience of the journey, just like seeing all of the United States all the way across. You know, just getting the full breadth of that vision is I think the overall highlight.
Would you
it's
do
not
it
a
again?
Particular scene. I would do a different route. I would not do. I definitely am, like, more open to taking another train to going somewhere, especially because I proved that I could sleep on it pretty comfortably if I really kind of relaxed and did it right. But I don't think I would need to do the route that I did before going along the southern United States. I think it would go along the middle or the north of the United States next time.
Awesome. Well, thank you
maybe
for
next year.
Thank you for definitely next year.
I said maybe. Yeah, you should come along.
I am there. We will broadcast live the Sophisticates from a train, I hope. Well, unless we don't bring our laptops, in which case we'll be too mellow to broadcast podcasts or whatnot. Anyway, thank you very much for indulging me. That sounds like an amazing trip, and there are plenty of Instagrams that I will reblog on our Tumblr in the near future. So thank you. On that note, maybe let us move on to our second topic for today, the flawed system of March Madness.
Well, I want to preface this with the statement that I love March Madness. It's one of my favorite sporting times of the year. And the first weekend of March Madness, especially if I'm just sitting at home with my sister and not having to work, which unfortunately may not happen this year, you just sit there all day and you watch basketball game, and the game ends and you go straight into the next one, and it's beautiful. However, it's not a good method, and basically playoffs in general are not good methods of determining who is the best team. And you can look at many examples of this, but I mean, March Madness is, I think, the biggest, most obvious one, really, because every year you got your Cinderellas that, you know, break all the brackets, and everyone loves the Cinderellas. But are we really? Do we really think that VCU was one of the four best teams last year? I don't think so.
Are you asking if we think that?
Well, I guess I'm asking America. But
Fister, were they?
I think so. I emphatically agree.
Scientifically speaking, maybe.
Scientifically proven.
It's interesting that you bring this up, Rajan, because it's. And I didn't really think about it until you mentioned it, that sports are closer to drama than probably real competition. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely.
That they're all, like, that bracket playoff design is programmed to play up the theatrics of sports and not really discern a best of a best sort of thing.
Absolutely, especially in America. to be perfectly honest.
Really? How's it? What's the difference between World Cup, or is that what you mean?
Well, I mean, World Cup is the exact same thing. So I mean, I'm not saying only in America, but I'm saying especially in America. All American sports have a regular season and then you have a playoff, right? Every single one.
Okay, I'm gonna expose myself. I'm gonna expose myself. So I know that they have a regular season and then they have the playoffs, but you get your position in the playoffs based on the season, right? So it seems like you're leading to being the best team, even in a bracket.
Yes, in part. But if you look at, say, basketball, there are 30 teams. 16 of them make the playoffs. Okay. You're not really eliminating that many teams. Hockey, I think, is about the same. Baseball, it used to have, I think there were 32 teams, and they only had 8 playoff teams, which they've now upped to 10. But in any case, it's a pretty large group and of teams that are in the playoffs. So it's likely that the winner is going to be one of the best 10 teams, but it's not, you're not really.
Wait, so does everything go back to zero when the playoffs hit? I am such an idiot. Sports are obviously not my, I love watching sports, and I think I love watching March Madness and getting into it because of the heightened drama of it all, and just pitting teams against each other, and it's almost like cage match fight to the death, which is why I can watch them and enjoy it. But the specifics of it and how it all works is a bit convoluted for me, and I wonder if that's why it's not actually a great way to tell who's the best.
Well, I mean, what you just said explains exactly why. I mean, why people love March Madness is because of all the drama and the unpredictability of it. If we knew the best team was going to win, then there are only 3 or 4 teams that would have a chance of winning, and then nobody would really care.
But then, who's the best team? That's what I don't understand. How can you think that the best team doesn't win every year?
You don't know who the best team is. Okay, I mean, honestly, you don't know that for sure, and especially in college when they don't all play each other and they have unequal schedules and stuff. You don't really know, but what I'm saying is that number one seeds don't win that often. I don't know the numbers, but last year wasn't won by a one seed. It wasn't and
the people who they think are going to win never win.
They don't never win, but the number one overall seed in the tournament, I don't think is 1 in 10 years. Wow. So the team that the people who make the brackets think it's the best team hasn't won in 10 years. So, I mean, that says something, doesn't it?
It seems like they picked a number one team so that they don't win. It's almost like you're sealing the deal for that team. You are not going to win because nobody wants you to win. Nobody wants the first seed to win. It's all calculated. You know, I think of in the movie world of which I come. We just had the Oscars, and that's the sort of thing where it's like, the best picture never wins. It's always the one that people just calculate and they want to win. It's almost like it's strategically created so that one thing can win and either upset or make everyone pissed off and just keep the machine going. Do you think that it's that calculated? Is there a conspiracy of March Madness here to just keep the drama going, keep the cash flowing for March Madness?
Well, Not in terms of which team wins. I don't think there's any sort of conspiracy that says this team is going to win, but there absolutely is. People aren't going to mess with March Madness and make a best of seven series, which is more likely to choose the best team, but still not that great a chance.
So there's no way to pick the best team in basketball, in competitive sports in general, is there?
I think the best way, or I don't know if the best way, but one way that seems like it's more likely to choose the best team is kind of a league or round robin sort of situation where you have 20 teams and they all play each other 2 or 3 times, and then whoever has the best record at the end of that, you just say is the winner. But the problem with that is there's really no drama. Because a team could conceivably be so far ahead with 10 games to go that they've already sealed the deal.
Right. That's a great way to run intramural sports. Because you don't want to amp the drama up there.
Yeah, so but I mean, the drama is what sells sport. That's why people love sports, because you can have those last second buzzer beaters that send you to game seven, and then, you know, like, that's why it's fun to watch.
But Pfister's still not watching it.
No, I watch the playoffs.
You do?
Exactly.
Yeah, sometimes.
See, that's the thing. A lot more people will watch the playoffs than the regular season, because the playoffs have that added drama and everything.
Do you watch it so that you can drink at bars so much less or something? Commitment.
You get all the fun drama, but you don't have to like slog it through games that suck.
So actually, if it was designed so that there was a true winner, I mean, obviously it would be less dramatic, but it would probably just be inherently less interesting to you, Ryan, as
well,
a non-watcher.
I mean, I guess it depends. Like, is my goal, like, I mean, this is not like a... The sport has no like intrinsic worth in itself, like in terms of the watchers. Like they want to get the drama.
But don't you want to know that, you know, the best person is winning, regardless of if you have anything invested? You seem like an honorable man.
I think it goes the other. I mean, I think it's the other way. Like for me, my only interest is the drama. Like I could see as a true, you know, as a hardcore fan, yeah, I might be more interested in who the best team really was. And it sounds like we're saying it's something like a baseball season is a pretty good barometer of that.
I think, yeah, probably that would be a better barometer. But then even in that situation, if you have a team that's, you know, one or two games ahead of another team at the end of the season, you haven't really said this team is definitively better than the other team.
But don't you, and just to wrap up here, like, okay, we've established that the March Madness system is flawed, but that it amps us up with its flaws. Like, that's the point. But don't you want there to be, like, a true victor at the end? Like, as a sports fan, as someone who's invested in the whole season, not just the brackets and not just the playoffs, Rajan, as a fan, you want some sort of payoff for the best?
I mean, as a fan, I would like the Eagles to win the Super Bowl every year. You know, I want my team to win.
Sure.
But if they're not going to, I would much rather have the best team win. That's why, like, when teams like the Giants this year won the Super Bowl, or actually when the Giants won the Super Bowl before, neither of those teams were were that good. They were probably... there's no way that they were the best team in the league that those particular years, but they happened to win in the playoffs, you know?
Right.
And maybe you could say they got better when the going got tougher or whatever, but there's always inherent randomness in every sport. And the best team in the NFL or in March Madness is not going to beat the fifth best team every time. Like, that's not possible. Like, maybe they'll win 55% of the time or 60% of the time. But still, that means you have to win 60% of the time, like six times to get all the way through and win the title. So your probability of winning is, I can't do the math in that quickly, but it's probably like 20% or less. It's less than that, probably.
For some reason, I'm imagining this, like, dirt pit in a back alley and 36 people coming with their, you know, bloodthirsty hounds and unleashing them all in a pit, and like everyone wants their own dog to win, but they're all just mauling each other and everyone's screaming and having a great time.
Okay, Mike Vick.
Yes, okay, Mike Vick is screaming and having a good time, and all of his friends. Well, it's just like it's such a gore fest, and no one cares. Like, no one's rooting for the best. They're just rooting for all of them to like slaughter each other in these crazy dramatic games. It's really funny to me, but I have such a good time too. I can't look away, and I guess that's the point. You can't look away from March Madness, thus madness. Well, there you go. Anyway, why don't we move on to our third and final topic for today? It's epic. I had to take a deep breath and pause because we're really coming to the end of something here. The barbershop intimidation factor. As you may know, listeners of the Sophisticates, we tend to end each show discussing a very important topic, haircuts, specifically Pfister's haircuts. But we finally decided that stare death in the face, tackle the subject full head on, because I think it's something that we've all had issues with. I know I do. Apparently Rajan does, because he experienced it today. But when you go to the barber shop, when you go get your hair cut, what do you do? Like, how do you know what's right and what's wrong? How do you go into a chair and get the what you're hoping to get out of that experience? It's such a roll of the dice, especially I feel that way. But Rajan, what was your experience today?
Well, okay, so my hair has been getting out of control. I hadn't had it cut since August, maybe.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
What does your mother think? No, I'm sorry.
But yeah, so I mean, this isn't something I do often, so I'm not, I guess, as expert as in saying what I'm really supposed to do, especially when I go to a new place. And so I just went to a place actually across the street from my office in New York. So the first thing is, like, you have to describe what you want. And really all I wanted was them to cut a lot of hair off so I wouldn't have to come back for another 6 months.
Less hair.
Like, that's really all I wanted. I just wanted a lot of hair off so I won't have to come back for 6 months and, you know, just and have it look decent. That's I don't know. I don't think I asked.
Perfectly reasonable.
So I go in there and I say something like cut off like 2 or 3 inches all around or whatever. And so then they proceed and they do it and they cut away. But then I don't feel like I feel like I want more hair cut off or something. And so like I ask for more and okay, so he begrudgingly does it. But then once I'm done, he like, you know, they always like, they show you the back with the mirror, right? After they've already like taken off the what's it called? The tarp or whatever that they draped with. So basically they're saying I'm done.
The tarp, yeah.
But then they show you the back and say, what do you think? And I felt like I wanted more off there. So I just said, you know, you sure? Like, can you take off a bit more there? And, it wouldn't work, you know, it would ruin the shape of the cut or something. And I'm just like,
So you're backseat haircutting right now. That's what you did to this man or woman.
But I feel like it's my hair. I have a right to do that.
True. So it didn't happen? Like, you couldn't convince him to continue cutting your hair?
He'd already decided he was done.
So I guess the biggest problem is knowing, you know, I put my trust into a barber. You know, I never know. I do not know how to ask for my hair to be cut. But I feel like I'm going to them for their guidance in this respect. Like, give me something fashionable. Give me something appropriately cut. Like, I'm looking to drop a few pounds here with my gigantic do. You know, but make it look good. But the main problem is that what you think looks good doesn't necessarily look good to them, or they have ideas, and obviously there's photos all over the wall. But to really step up, and my biggest problem is I don't have the confidence to do this usually, is you need to take a picture. You need to take a picture of what you want and show them what the haircut looks like, or you're never going to get what you want.
Well, no, I mean, but here's the thing. Like, I totally agree with this, trying to trust the bartender. And I think that the bartenders...
I think he's a barber.
Oh, right, barber. Good call.
If the bartender is cutting your hair, you have a serious problem.
But I think that the barbers don't really embrace this role as like the fashion expert. Like, I would very much like
artisan
to go to a barber or a hairstylist or whatever and just say, okay, just like make it look okay.
But isn't that what salons are? I mean, aren't you going into a salon to get like the artistic haircut or the vision of someone? A barber is just there to like snip your bangs or whatnot.
I guess. Yeah, I don't know. I maybe I should try a
high-end
salon.
How much do you pay
salon
for your haircut?
Like $16.
And don't think you're getting your $16 worth necessarily?
No, I think I guess it kind of depends on what you're looking for the $16. It just seems like a lot of people in hair are artistic. It seems like they must have some conception of what they think your hair should look like, but they don't seem to talk about it.
I do think cutting hair is an art that not many people... I mean, you need to learn how to do it. You need to study. You need to have your own vision of how it works, and you need to develop a craft. and it's an underappreciated art. But, you know, if you try and play around, then you're going to piss too many people off. Barbers can't take chances because they're going to anger people. It's going to be like Rajan, which is sit down in my chair. I'm going to do it the way I think it's right. So don't tell me it's wrong when I'm done. That's what art is. Art is doing it for yourself, not for the person, not for the consumer.
That's true.
You're commissioning this haircut. You're a patron of the arts when you go to a barbershop.
The camarada is going to sing your haircut.
I'm not trying to commission a haircut. I just want my hair to be shorter.
You're right. Rajan has different goals than we do here.
That's fascinating. Then why don't you... Have you ever brought a picture in, either of yourself or of someone with the haircut you want?
I have not.
You need a blueprint. You need a guideline.
Perhaps. I don't generally put in that much forethought into my haircuts, honestly.
Well, then you can't be unhappy.
Perhaps not.
Well, no, I think part of it is the approach here. Like, I think that you have to be very forthright about the fact that you want it short. And if you see him take, I agree with your thing. I mean, I think the fact that he was starting to take off the tarp, maybe that the best practice for the future here is that you should demand to see the back before the tarp is removed.
I think you need to say something before you start the person cuts your hair. I think you need to be upfront about your own goals. You know.
Yeah, but see, the problem is my goal. I feel guilty airing my goal in the barbershop, which is essentially
you should
I want
guilty.
To spend as little money on barbershop on haircuts as possible, by which I mean I want you to cut off as much hair as I can so it's the longest before I next have to have my hair cut.
Well, they're not like cutting it off based on the amount of money you're paying them.
Exactly.
Right, so just you need to be upfront. I'm not feeling your confidence in the barbershop chair right now.
It's because of the intimidation factor.
Yeah.
But what is intimidating then?
I guess for me, it's always been a language issue. It's like, yeah, I want it like it is now, but shorter, but not too short. Or I guess maybe, Rajan, you would just say shorter. but that's not very precise.
No.
Is it us not knowing our own hair well enough? Like, I feel that way. I don't feel like, and this you mentioned this, Rajan, that I spend enough time kind of calculating exactly what I want and analyzing my own hair to be able to effectively describe what I'm looking for. It's like we don't have we don't have value in our own follicle aesthetics.
I mean, maybe we need a hair language.
Well, like, in this particular case, there may have just been a general language. Straight up language issue because I think he was Eastern European of some sort.
You were lost in translation at the barbershop.
I don't know. There wasn't a whole lot of exchange, but it felt like he didn't really want much exchange.
So would you ever take a picture in? I'm always debating this. I'm always telling myself, yes, I am going to print out a picture of a celebrity with a good haircut and show them this picture and say, this is what I want. And then I get way too embarrassed, and I can't do that, so I go to the haircut place and just say short, and then I get something that I'm unhappy
with.
See,
Patches, you're getting intimidated, too.
I am intimidated. I won't deny that. I'm definitely playing devil's advocate when I grill you on this. I am 100% intimidated because, like you said, Ryan, I do not have the language to be able to convey what I want. And so I need to use visual evidence. And why wouldn't you? Because it's your hair, your look is a visual thing. So there's no hope for you if you're not going to step it up, Rajan.
Yeah, I guess I'm just going to have to do the picture.
Buzz cut. I think that's the answer you're looking for. Buzz cut.
That did happen to me once in high school.
You got a buzz cut?
Yeah, I actually got a buzz cut in the locker room.
This is getting weird. Whatever you're talking about right now is getting weird. Well, I think the only way to wrap up this conversation logically is asking Ryan if he got a haircut.
I did get a haircut. Finally, I actually went back to the old Supercuts.
Before the train trip, I hope.
Before the train trip, yeah. I got it in Lower Gwynedd. Just went back to the old haircut place, and they did a fine job.
What did you tell them?
Oh, I think I told them shorter but not too short.
that's point. Well, at a Supercuts, that's exactly what they want to hear.
Well, I think that's a very specific thing, because if you just stay shorter, they make it pretty short. But you have to. I try to emphasize the not too short part. That's my new extravagance.
Sister, I do think when you go into the haircut with less hair, they have less choice in the matter. So you're more likely to be closer to what you want. When you go in there with lots of hair, then there's all sorts of media between, like, what does shorter but not too short actually even mean? Does it mean, you know?
Here's what I recommend you do, Ranjan, next time you get a haircut. You should actually take a pair of scissors to your own head, cut an extreme amount of hair off, and then have them just, like, shape the rest of it for you. Don't let a barber cut your shaggy hairdo off. Get someone else to cut it, and then they'll shape it. They'll tidy it up. They'll detail it. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see. I just basically go, I was sleeping, and some friend just broke into my room and cut off a whole chunk of my hair. Can you please fix this?
Exactly. I think if you're looking for the chop, you should go to Supercuts. I think that's the place to do it. I think
that
if you're looking for artistry...
I think I was more satisfied with that.
Don't go to an Eastern European barber in New York City. They are artists.
Well, let's get we'll have a little haircut support group if anybody needs encouragement before they go in to be a man.
Yeah,
we'll go on the Sophisticates first.
People should tweet us their horrible haircut stories. I'm very interested to see if we're alone in this. Maybe we're just really sad, antisocial people who can't convey their true thoughts to barbers. Well, in that case, as we usually do, we end knowing that the three of us are total losers. But that is why we're together doing the Sophisticates every 2 weeks, right? 2 weeks now. And you can find new episodes on iTunes. You can find us on Tumblr, thesophisticates.tumblr.com. We're on Twitter, @Sophisticast. And yes, you should leave reviews and rate the podcast and rave about us and tell all your friends and share it, because that's how these amazing ideas and conversations get out there into the world. So thank you for listening. Go get a haircut and tell us how it goes. And we will see you next time.